The other inmates would be the first men with whom he could associate on a basis of equality. Steel bars between him and the society he offended would provide a refuge from hate and fear. "You cannot kill this man, Your Honor, for we have made it plain that we do not recognize that he lives. So I say, give him life. This will not solve the problem which this crime exemplifies. That remains, perhaps, for the future. But if we say that we must kill him, then let us have the courage and honesty to say, let us kill them all. They are not human. There's no room for them. Then let us do it. We cannot, by giving him life in prison, help the others. We do not ask that this court even try. But we can remember that whether this boy lives or dies, the marked-off ghettos where this boy lived will remain. The mounting tide of hate on the one hand, and guilt on the other, one engendering fear and hate, and the other engendering guilt and rage, will continue to grow. But at least this ruling, the sending of this boy to jail, out of the considerations I have named, will be the first recognition of what is involved here. I say, Your Honor, give this boy his life. And in making this concession, we uphold those two fundamental concepts of our civilization, those two basic concepts upon which we have built the mightiest nation in history, personality and security, the conviction that the person is inviolate, and that which sustains him is equally so. Let us not forget that the magnitude of our modern life, our railroads, power plants, ocean liners, airplanes, and steel mills, flowered from these two concepts, grew from our dream of creating an invulnerable base upon which man and his soul can stand secure. Your Honor, this court and those troops are not the real agencies that keep the public peace. Their mere presence is proof that we are letting peace slip through our fingers. Public peace is the act of public trust. It is the faith that all are secure and will remain secure. When men of wealth urge the use and show of force, quick death, swift revenge, then it is to protect a little spot of private security against the resentful millions from whom they have filched it, the resentful millions in whose militant hearts the dream and hope of security still lives. Your Honor, I ask in the name of all we are and believe that you spare this boy's life. With every atom of my being, I beg this in order that not only may this black boy live, but that we ourselves may not die. Bigger heard Max's last words ring out in the courtroom. When Max sat down, he saw that his eyes were tired and sunken. He could hear his breath coming and going heavily. He had not understood the speech, but he had felt the meaning of some of it from the tone of Max's voice. Suddenly, he felt that his life was not worth the effort that Max had made to save it. The judge rapped the gavel, calling a recess. The court was full of noise as Bigger rose. The policeman marched him to a small room and stood waiting on guard. Max came and sat beside him, silent, his head bowed. A policeman brought a tray of food and set it on the table. "Eat, son," Max said. I ain't hungry. I did the best I could, Max said. I'm all right, Bigger said. Bigger was not at that moment really bothered about whether Max's speech had saved his life or not. He was hugging the proud thought that Max had made the speech all for him, to save his life. It was not the meaning of the speech that gave him pride, but the mere act of it. That in itself was something. The food on the tray grew cold. Through a partly opened window, Bigger heard the rumbling voice of the mob. Soon he would go back and hear what Buckley would say. Then it would be all over, save for what the judge would say. And when the judge spoke, he would know if he was to live or die. He leaned his head on his hands and closed his eyes. He heard Max stand up, strike a match, and light a cigarette. Here, take a smoke, Bigger. He took one, and Max held the flame. He sucked the smoke deep into his lungs, and discovered that he did not want it. He held the cigarette in his fingers, and the smoke curled up past his bloodshot eyes. He jerked his head when the door opened. A policeman looked in.
Court's opening in 2 minutes.
All right, Max said.
This ends Disc 14. Native Son, Disc 15.
Flanked again by policemen, Bigger went back to court. He rose when the judge came, and then sat again. The court will hear the state, the judge said. Bigger turned his head and saw Buckley rise. He was dressed in a black suit, and there was a tiny pink flower in the lapel of his coat. The man's very look and bearing, so grimly assured, made Bigger feel that he was already lost. What chance had he against a man like that? Buckley licked his lips and looked out over the crowd. Then he turned to the judge. Your Honor, we all dwell in a land of living law. Law embodies the will of the people. As an agent and servant of the law, as a representative of the organized will of the people, I am here to see that the will of the people is executed firmly and without delay. I intend to stand here and see that that is done. And if it is not done, then it will be only over my most solemn and emphatic protest. As a prosecuting officer of the state of Illinois, I come before this honorable court to urge that the full extent of the law, the death penalty, the only penalty of the law that is feared by murderers, be allowed to take its course in this most important case. I urge this for the protection of our society, our homes, and our loved ones. I urge this in the performance of my sworn duty to see, insofar as I am humanly capable, that the administration of law is just, that the safety and sacredness of human life are maintained, that the social order is kept intact, and that crime is prevented and punished. I have no interest or feeling in this case beyond the performance of this sworn duty. I represent the families of Mary Dalton and Bessie Mears and 100 million law-abiding men and women of this nation who are laboring in duty or industry. I represent the forces which allow the arts and sciences to flourish in freedom and peace, thereby enriching the lives of us all. I shall not lower the dignity of this court, nor the righteousness of the people's cause by attempting to answer the silly, alien, communistic, and dangerous ideas advanced by the defense. And I know of no better way to discourage such thinking than the imposition of the death penalty upon this miserable human fiend, Bigger Thomas. My voice may sound harsh when I say, impose the death penalty, and let the law take its course in spite of the specious call for sympathy. But I am really merciful and sympathetic. because the enforcement of this law in its most drastic form will enable millions of honest men and women to sleep in peace tonight. To know that tomorrow will not bring the black shadow of death over their homes and lives. My voice may sound vindictive when I say, make the defendant pay the highest penalty for his crimes. But what I am really saying is that the law is sweet when it is enforced and protects a million worthy careers, when it shields the infant, the aged, the helpless, the blind, and the sensitive from the ravishing of men who know no law, no self-control, and no sense of reason. My voice may sound cruel when I say, the defendant merits the death penalty for his self-confessed crimes. But what I'm really saying is that the law is strong and gracious enough to allow all of us to sit here in this courtroom today and try this case with dispassionate interest, and not to tremble with fear that at this very moment some half-human black ape may be climbing through the windows of our homes to rape, murder, and burn our daughters. Your Honor, I say that the law is holy, that it is the foundation of all our cherished values. It permits us to take for granted the sense of the worth of our persons and turn our energies to higher and nobler ends. Man stepped forward from the kingdom of the beast the moment he felt that he could think and feel insecurity, knowing that sacred law had taken the place of his gun and knife. I say that the law is holy because it makes us human, and woe to the men and the civilization of those men who in misguided sympathy or fear weaken the stout structure of the law, which ensures the harmonious working of our lives on this earth. Your Honor, I regret that the defense has raised the viperous issue of race and class hate in this trial. I sympathize with those whose hearts were pained, as mine was pained, when Mr. Max so cynically assailed our sacred customs. I pity this man's deluded and diseased mind. It is a sad day for American civilization when a white man will try to stay the hand of justice from a bestial monstrosity who has ravished and struck down one of the finest and most delicate flowers of our womanhood. Every decent white man in America ought to swoon with joy for the opportunity to crush with his heel the woolly head of this black lizard, to keep him from scuttling on his belly farther over the earth and spitting forth his venom of death. Your Honor, literally I shrink from the mere recital of this dastardly crime. I cannot speak of it without feeling somehow contaminated by the mere telling of it. A bloody crime has that power. It is that steeped and dyed with repellent contagion. A wealthy, kindly disposed white man, a resident of Chicago for more than 40 years, sends to the relief agency for a Negro boy to act as chauffeur to his family. The man specifies in his request that he wants a boy who is handicapped either by race, poverty, or family responsibility. The relief authorities search through their records and select the Negro family which they think merits such aid. That family was the Thomas family, living then as now at 3721 Indiana Avenue. A social worker visits the family and informs the mother that the family is to be taken off the relief rolls and her son placed in private employment. The mother, a hard-working Christian woman, consents. In due time, the relief authorities send a notification to the oldest son of the family, Bigger Thomas, this black mad dog who sits here today, telling him that he must report for work. What was the reaction of this sly thug when he learned that he had an opportunity to support himself, his mother, his little sister, and his little brother? Was he grateful?
Was he glad that he was having something offered to him that 10 million men in America would have fallen on their knees and thanked God for? No! He cursed his mother. He said that he did not want to work. He wanted to loaf about the streets, steal from newsstands, rob stores, meddle with women, frequent dives, attend cheap movies, and chase prostitutes. That was the reaction of this subhuman killer when he was confronted with the Christian kindness of a man he had never seen. His mother prevailed upon him, pled with him. But the plight of his mother, worn out from a life of toil, had no effect upon this hardened black thing. The future of his sister, an adolescent schoolgirl, meant nothing to him. The fact that the job would have enabled his brother to return to school was not enticing to Bigger Thomas. But suddenly, after 3 days of persuasion by his mother, he consented. Had any of her arguments reached him at long last? Had he begun to feel his duty toward himself and his family? No! Those were not the considerations that drove this rapacious beast from his den into the open. He consented only when his mother informed him that the relief would cut off their supply of food if he did not accept. He agreed to go to work, but forbade his mother to speak to him within the confines of the home. So outraged was he that he had to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow. It was hunger that drove him out, sullen, angry, still longing to stay upon the streets and steal as he had done before, and for which he had once landed in a reform school. The counsel for the defendant, with characteristic communistic cunning, boasted that I could not supply a motive for the crimes of this beast. Well, Your Honor, I shall disappoint him, for I shall divulge the motive. On the very day that Bigger Thomas was to report to the Dalton home for work, he saw a newsreel in a movie. This newsreel showed Mary Dalton in a bathing suit upon a Florida beach. Jack Harding, a friend of Bigger Thomas, under persistent questioning, admitted that Bigger Thomas was enthralled by the idea of driving such a girl around the city. Let us be frank and not gloss over words. This court has already heard of the obnoxious sexual perversions practiced by these boys in darkened theaters. Though Jack Harding would not admit it outright, we got enough information out of him to know that when the shadow of Mary Dalton was moving upon that screen, those boys indulged in such an act. It was then that the idea of rape, murder, and ransom entered the mind of this moron. There is your motive, the vile circumstances under which it was conceived. After seeing that movie, he went to the Dalton home. He was welcomed there with lavish kindness. He was given a room. He was told that he would receive extra money for himself, over and above his weekly wages. He was fed. He was asked if he wanted to go back to school and learn a trade, but he refused. His mind and heart, if this beast can be said to have a mind and heart, were not set upon any such goals. Less than an hour after he had been in that house, he met Mary Dalton, who asked him if he wanted to join a union. Mr. Max, whose heart bleeds for labor, did not tell us why his client should have resented that. What black thoughts passed through that Negro's scheming brain the first few moments after he saw that trusting white girl standing before him? We have no way of knowing. And perhaps this piece of human scum who sits here today begging for mercy is wise in not telling us. But we can use our imagination. We can look upon what he subsequently did and surmise. 2 hours later, he was driving Miss Dalton to the Loop. Here occurs the first misunderstanding in this case. The general notion is that Miss Dalton, by having this Negro drive her to the loop instead of to school, was committing an act of disobedience against her family. But that is not for us to judge. That is for Mary Dalton and her God to settle. It was admitted by her family that she went contrary to a wish of theirs. But Mary Dalton was of age and went where she pleased. This Negro drove Miss Dalton to the loop, where she was joined by a young white man, a friend of hers. From there they went to a Southside cafe and ate and drank. Being in a Negro neighborhood, they invited this Negro to eat with them. When they talked, they included him in their conversation. When liquor was ordered, enough was bought so that he, too, could drink. Afterwards, he drove the couple through Washington Park for some 2 hours. Around 2 o'clock in the morning, this friend of Miss Dalton's left the car and went to visit some friends of his. Mary Dalton was left alone in that car with this Negro, who had received nothing from her but kindness. From that point onward, we have no exact knowledge of what really happened, for we have only this black cur's bare word for it, and I am convinced that he is not telling us all. We don't know just when Mary Dalton was killed, but we do know this. Her head was completely severed from her body. We know that both the head and the body were stuffed into the furnace and burned. My God! What bloody scenes must have taken place! How swift and unexpected must have been that lustful and murderous attack! How that poor child must have struggled to escape that maddened ape! How she must have pled on bended knee with tears in her eyes to be spared the vile touch of his horrible person! Your Honor, must not this infernal monster have burned her body to destroy evidence of offenses worse than rape? That treacherous beast must have known that if the marks of his teeth were ever seen on the innocent white flesh of her breasts, he would not have been accorded the high honor of sitting here in this court of law. Oh, suffering Christ! There are no words to tell of a deed so black and awful. And the defense would have us believe that this was an act of creation? It is a wonder that God in heaven did not drown out his lying voice with a thunderous no. It is enough to make the blood stop flowing in one's veins to hear a man excuse this cowardly and beastly crime on the ground that it was instinctive. The next morning, Bigger Thomas took Miss Dalton's trunk half-packed to the LaSalle Street station and prepared to send it off as though nothing had happened, as though Miss Dalton were still alive. But the bones of Miss Dalton's body were found in the furnace that evening. The burning of the body and the taking of the half-packed trunk to the station mean just one thing. Your Honor, it shows that the rape and murder were planned, that an attempt was made to destroy evidence so that the crime could be carried on to the point of ransom. If Miss Dalton were accidentally killed, as this Negro so pathetically tried to make us believe when he first confessed, then why did he burn her body? Why did he take her trunk to the station when he knew that she was dead? There is but one answer. He planned to rape, to kill, to collect. He burned the body to get rid of evidences of rape. He took the trunk to the station to gain time in which to burn the body and prepare the kidnap note. He killed her because he raped her. Mind you, Your Honor, the central crime here is rape. Every action points toward that. Knowing that the family had called in private investigators, the Negro tried to throw suspicion elsewhere. In other words, he was not above seeing an innocent man die for his crime. When he could not kill any more, he did the next best thing. He lied. He sought to blame the crime upon one of Miss Dalton's friends, whose political beliefs he thought would damn him. He told wild lies of taking the two of them, Miss Dalton and her friend, to a room. He said that he had been told to go home and leave the car out in the snow in the driveway all night. Knowing that his lies were being found out, he tried yet another scheme. He tried to collect money. Did he flee the scene when the investigators were at work? No. Coldly. Without feeling. He stayed on in the Dalton home. Ate. Slept. Basking in the misguided kindness of Mr. Dalton, who refused to allow him to be questioned upon the theory that he was a poor boy who needed protection. He needed as much protection as you would give a coiled rattler. While the family was searching heaven and earth for their daughter, this ghoul writes a kidnap note demanding $10,000 for the safe return of Miss Dalton. But the discovery of the bones in the furnace put that foul dream to an end. And the defense would have us believe that this man acted in fear. Has fear, since the beginning of time, driven men to such lengths of calculation? Again, we have but the bare word of this worthless ape to go on. He fled the scene and went to the home of a girl, Bessie Mears, with whom he had long been intimate. There something occurred that only a cunning beast could have done. This girl had been frightened into helping him collect the ransom money, and he had placed in her keeping the money he had stolen from the corpse of Mary Dalton. He killed that poor girl, and even yet it staggers my mind to think that such a plan for murder could have been hatched in a human brain. He persuaded this girl, who loved him deeply, despite the assertions of Mr. Max, that godless communist who tried to make you believe otherwise. As I said, he persuaded this girl, who loved him deeply, to run away with him. They hid in an abandoned building, and there, with a blizzard raging outside in the sub-zero cold and darkness, he committed rape and murder again, twice in 24 hours. I repeat, Your Honor, I cannot understand it. I have dealt with many a murder in my long service to the state, but never have I encountered the equal of this. So eager was this demented savage to rape and kill that he forgot the only thing that might have helped him to escape. That is, the money he had stolen from the dead body of Mary Dalton, which was in the pocket of Bessie Mears' dress. He took the ravished body of that poor working girl. The money was in her dress, I say, and dumped it four floors down an air shaft. The doctors told us that the girl was not dead when she hit the bottom of that shaft. She froze to death later, trying to climb out. Your Honor, I spare you the ghastly details of these murders. The witnesses have told all. But I demand, in the name of the people of this state, that this man die for these crimes. I demand this, so that others may be deterred from similar crimes, so that peaceful and industrious people may be safe. Your Honor, millions are waiting for your word. They are waiting for you to tell them that jungle law does not prevail in this city. They want you to tell them that they need not sharpen their knives and load their guns to protect themselves. They are waiting, Your Honor, beyond that window. Give them your word so that they can, with calm hearts, plan for the future. Slay the dragon of doubt that causes a million hearts to pause tonight, a million hands to tremble as they lock their doors. When men are pursuing their normal rounds of duty, and a crime as black and bloody as this is committed, they become paralyzed. The more horrible the crime, the more stunned, shocked, and dismayed is the tranquil city in which it happens. The more helpless are the citizens before it. Restore confidence to those of us who still survive, so that we may go on and reap the rich harvests of life. Your Honor, in the name of Almighty God, I plead with you to be merciful to us. Buckley's voice boomed in Bigger's ears, and he knew what the loud commotion meant when the speech had ended. In the back of the room, several newspaper men were scrambling for the door. Buckley wiped his red face and sat down. The judge rapped for order and said, "Court will adjourn for 1 hour." Max was on his feet. "Your Honor, you cannot do this. Is it your intention? More time is needed, you..."
"The court will give its decision then," the judge said.
There were shouts. Bigger saw Max's lips moving, but he could not make out what he was saying. Slowly the room quieted. Bigger saw that the expressions on the faces of the men and women were different now. He felt that the thing had been decided. He knew that he was to die.
"Your Honor,"
Max said, his voice breaking from an intensity of emotion.
"It seems that for careful consideration of the evidence and discussion submitted, more time is..."
"The court reserves the right to determine how much time is needed, Mr. Max," the judge said.
Bigger knew that he was lost. It was but a matter of time, a formality. He did not know how he got back into the little room, but when he was brought in, he saw the tray of food still there, uneaten. He sat down and looked at the six policemen who stood silently by. Guns hung from their hips. Ought he to try to snatch one and shoot himself? But he did not have enough spirit to respond positively to the idea of self-destruction. He was paralyzed with dread. Max came in, sat, and lit a cigarette.
"Well, son, we'll have to wait. We've got an hour."
There was a banging on the door.
"Don't let any of those reporters in here," Max told a policeman.
"Okay."
Minutes passed. Bigger's head began to ache with the suspense of it. He knew that Max had nothing to say to him, and he had nothing to say to Max. He had to wait, that was all. Wait for something he knew was coming. His throat tightened. He felt cheated. Why did they have to have a trial if it had to end this way?
"Well, I reckon it's all over for me now," Bigger sighed, speaking as much for himself as for Max.
"I don't know," Max said.
"I know," Bigger said.
"Well, let's wait."
"He's making up his mind too quick. I know I'm going to die."
"I'm sorry, Bigger. Listen, why don't you eat?"
"I ain't hungry."
"This thing isn't over yet. I can ask the governor."
"It ain't no use. They got me."
"You don't know."
"I know."
Max said nothing. Bigger leaned his head upon the table and closed his eyes. He wished Max would leave him now. Max had done all he could. He should go home and forget him. The door opened.
"The judge will be ready in 5 minutes.
Max stood up. Bigger looked at his tired face.
"All right, son, come on."
Walking between policemen,
Bigger followed Max back into the courtroom. He did not have time to sit down before the judge came in. He remained standing until the judge was seated. Then he slid weakly into his chair. Max rose to speak, but the judge lifted his hand for silence.
Will Bigger Thomas rise and face the court?
The room was full of noise, and the judge rapped for quiet. With trembling legs, Bigger rose, feeling in the grip of a nightmare.
Is there any statement you wish to make before a sentence is passed upon you?
He tried to open his mouth to answer, but could not. Even if he had had the power of speech, he did not know what he could have said. He shook his head, his eyes blurring. The courtroom was profoundly quiet now. The judge wet his lips with his tongue and lifted a piece of paper that crackled loudly in the silence.
In view of the unprecedented disturbance of the public mind, the duty of this court is clear, the judge said, and paused.
Bigger groped for the edge of the table with his hand and clung to it.
In number 666-983, indictment for murder, the sentence of this court is that you, Bigger Thomas, shall die on or before midnight of Friday, March 3rd, in a manner prescribed by the laws of this state. This court finds your age to be 20. The sheriff may retire with the prisoner.
Bigger understood every word, and he seemed not to react to the words, but to the judge's face. He did not move. He stood looking up into the judge's white face, his eyes not blinking. Then he felt a hand upon his sleeve. Max was pulling him back into his seat. The room was in an uproar. The judge rapped with his gavel. Max was on his feet, trying to say something. There was too much noise, and Bigger could not tell what it was. The handcuffs were clicked upon him, and he was led through the underground passage back to his cell. He lay on the cot, and something deep down in him said, "It's over now. It's all over." Later on, the door opened, and Max came in and sat softly beside him on the cot. Bigger turned his face to the wall.
"I'll see the governor, Bigger. It's not over yet."
"Go away," Bigger whispered.
"You've got to."
"No, go away." He felt Max's hand on his arm, then it left. He heard the steel door clang shut, and he knew that he was alone. He did not stir. He lay still, feeling that by being still he would stave off feeling and thinking, and that was what he wanted above all right now. Slowly his body relaxed. In the darkness and silence, he turned over on his back and crossed his hands upon his chest. His lips moved in a whimper of despair. In self-defense, he shut out the night and day from his mind, for if he had thought of the sun's rising and setting, of the moon or the stars, of clouds or rain, he would have died 1,000 deaths before they took him to the chair. To accustom his mind to death as much as possible, he made all the world beyond his cell a vast gray land, where neither night nor day was, peopled by strange men and women whom he could not understand, but with whose lives he longed to mingle once before he went. He did not eat now. He simply forced food down his throat without tasting it, to keep the gnawing pain of hunger away, to keep from feeling dizzy. And he did not sleep. At intervals he closed his eyes for a while, no matter what the hour, then opened them at some later time to resume his brooding. He wanted to be free of everything that stood between him and his end, him in the full and terrible realization that life was over without meaning, without anything being settled, without conflicting impulses being resolved. His mother and brother and sister had come to see him, and he had told them to stay home, not to come again, to forget him. The Negro preacher who had given him the cross had come, and he had driven him away. A white priest had tried to persuade him to pray, and he had thrown a cup of hot coffee into his face. The priest had come to see other prisoners since then, but had not stopped to talk with him. That had evoked in Bigger a sense of his worth, almost as keen as that which Max roused in him during the long talk that night. He felt that his making the priest stand away from him and wonder about his motives for refusing to accept the consolations of religion was a sort of recognition of his personality on a plane other than that which the priest was ordinarily willing to make. Max had told him that he was going to see the governor, but he had heard no more from him. He did not hope that anything would come of it. He referred to it in his thoughts and feelings as something happening outside of his life, which could not in any way alter or influence the course of it. But he did want to see Max and talk with him again. He recalled the speech Max had made in court and remembered with gratitude the kind, impassioned tone. But the meaning of the words escaped him. He believed that Max knew how he felt, and once more before he died, he wanted to talk with him and feel with as much keenness as possible what his living and dying meant. That was all the hope he had now. If there were any sure and firm knowledge for him, it would have to come from himself. He was allowed to write 3 letters a week, but he had written to no one. There was no one to whom he had anything to say, for he had never given himself wholeheartedly to anyone or anything, except murder. What could he say to his mother and brother and sister? Of the old gang, only Jack had been his friend, and he had never been so close to Jack as he would have liked. And Bessie was dead. He had killed her. When tired of mulling over his feelings, he would say to himself that it was he who was wrong, that he was no good. If he could have really made himself believe that, it would have been a solution. But he could not convince himself. His feelings clamored for an answer his mind could not give. All his life he had been most alive, most himself, when he had felt things hard enough to fight for them. And now, here in this cell, he felt more than ever the hard central core of what he had lived. As the white mountain had once loomed over him, so now the black wall of death loomed closer with each fleeting hour. But he could not strike out blindly now. Death was a different and bigger adversary. Though he lay on his cot, his hands were groping, fumblingly through the city of men for something to match the feelings smoldering in him. His groping was a yearning to know. Frantically, his mind sought to fuse his feelings with the world about him, but he was no nearer to knowing than ever. Only his black body lay here on the cot, wet with the sweat of agony. If he were nothing, if this were all, then why could not he die without hesitancy? Who and what was he to feel the agony of a wonder so intensely that it amounted to fear? Why was this strange impulse always throbbing in him, when there was nothing outside of him to meet it and explain it? Who or what had traced this restless design in him? Why was this eternal reaching for something that was not there? Why this black gulf between him and the world? Warm red blood here, and cold blue sky there, and never a wholeness, a oneness, a meeting of the two. Was that it? Was it simply fever, feeling without knowing, seeking without finding? Was this the all, the meaning, the end? With these feelings and questions, the minutes passed. He grew thin, and his eyes held the red blood of his body. The eve of his last day came. He longed to talk to Max more than ever. But what could he say to him? Yes, that was the joke of it. He could not talk about this thing, so elusive it was. and yet he acted upon it every living second. The next day at noon, a guard came to his cell and poked a telegram through the bars. He sat up and opened it. "Be brave. Governor failed. Done all possible. See you soon. Max." He balled the telegram into a tight knot and threw it into a corner. He had from now until midnight. He had heard that 6 hours before his time came, they would give him some more clothes, take him to the barber shop, and then take him to the death cell. He had been told by one of the guards not to worry, that 8 seconds after they take you out of your cell and put that black cap over your eyes, you'll be dead, boy. Well, he could stand that. He had in his mind a plan. He would flex his muscles, and shut his eyes and hold his breath, and think of absolutely nothing while they were handling him. And when the current struck him, it would all be over. He lay down again on the cot, on his back, and stared at the tiny, bright yellow electric bulb glowing on the ceiling above his head. It contained the fire of death. If only those tiny spirals of heat inside of that glass globe would wrap round him now. If only someone would attach the wires to his iron cot while he dozed off. If only when he was in a deep dream they would kill him. He was in an uneasy sleep when he heard the voice of a guard.
"Thomas, here's your lawyer."
He swung his feet to the floor and sat up. Max was standing at the bars. The guard unlocked the door, and Max walked in. Bigger had an impulse to rise, but he remained seated. Max came to the center of the floor and stopped. They looked at each other for a moment. "Hello, Bigger." Silently, Bigger shook hands with him. Max was before him, quiet, white, solid, real. His tangible presence seemed to belie all the vague thoughts and hopes that Bigger had woven round him in his broodings. He was glad that Max had come, but he was bewildered. "How are you feeling?" For an answer, Bigger sighed heavily. "You get my wire?" Max asked, sitting on the cot. Bigger nodded. "I'm sorry, son." There was silence. Max was at his side. The man who had lured him on a quest toward a dim hope was there. Well, why didn't he speak now? Here was his chance, his last chance. He lifted his eyes shyly to Max's. Max was looking at him. Bigger looked off. What he wanted to say was stronger in him when he was alone, and though he imputed to Max the feelings he wanted to grasp, he could not talk of them to Max until he had forgotten Max's presence. Then, fear that he would not be able to talk about this consuming fever made him panicky. He struggled for self-control. He did not want to lose this driving impulse. It was all he had. And in the next second, he felt that it was all foolish, useless, vain. He stopped trying, and in the very moment he stopped, he heard himself talking with tight throat, in tense, involuntary whispers. He was trusting the sound of his voice, rather than the sense of his words, to carry his meaning. "I'm all right, Mr. Max. You ain't to blame for what's happening to me. I know you did all you could." Under the pressure of a feeling of futility, his voice trailed off. After a short silence, he blurted, "I just reckon I had it coming." He stood up, full now, wanting to talk. His lips moved, but no words came. "Is there anything I can do for you, Bigger?" Max asked softly. Bigger looked at Max's gray eyes. How could he get into that man a sense of what he wanted? If he could only tell him. Before he was aware of what he was doing, He ran to the door and clutched the cold steel bars in his hands.
Yes, Bigger?
Slowly, Bigger turned and came back to the cot. He stood before Max again, about to speak, his right hand raised. Then he sat down and bowed his head.
What is it, Bigger?
Is there anything you want me to do on the outside? Any message you want to send?
Nah, he breathed.
What's on your mind?
I don't know.
He could not talk. Max reached over and placed a hand on his shoulder, and Bigger could tell by its touch that Max did not know, had no suspicion of what he wanted, of what he was trying to say. Max was upon another planet, far off in space. Was there any way to break down this wall of isolation? Distractedly, he gazed about the cell, trying to remember where he had heard words that would help him. He could recall none. He had lived outside of the lives of men. Their modes of communication, their symbols and images, had been denied him. Yet Max had given him the faith that at bottom all men lived as he lived, and felt as he felt. And of all the men he had met, surely Max knew what he was trying to say. Had Max left him? Had Max, knowing that he was to die, thrust him from his thoughts and feelings, assigned him to the grave? Was he already numbered among the dead? His lips quivered, and his eyes grew misty. Yes, Max had left him. Max was not a friend. Anger welled in him. But he knew that anger was useless. Max rose and went to a small window. A pale bar of sunshine fell across his white head. And Bigger, looking at him, saw that sunshine for the first time in many days. And as he saw it, the entire cell with its four close walls became crushingly real. He glanced down at himself. The shaft of yellow sun cut across his chest, with as much weight as a beam forged of lead. With a convulsive gasp, he bent forward and shut his eyes. It was not a white mountain looming over him now. Gus was not whistling. The merry-go-round broke down as he came into Doc's pool room to make him go and rob Blum's. He was not standing over Mary's bed with the white blur hovering near. This new adversary did not make him taut. It sapped strength and left him weak. He summoned his energies and lifted his head and struck out desperately, determined to rise from the grave, resolved to force upon Max the reality of his living.
"I'm glad I got to know you before I go," he said with almost a shout,
then was silent, for that was not what he had wanted to say. Max turned and looked at him. It was a casual look, devoid of the deeper awareness that Bigger sought so hungrily.
"I'm glad I got to know you too, Bigger. I'm sorry we have to part this way. But I'm old, son. I'll be going soon myself. I remembered all them questions you asked me."
"What questions?" Max asked, coming and sitting again on the cot.
"That night."
"What night, son?"
Max did not even know. Bigger felt that he had been slapped. Oh, what a fool he had been to build hope upon such shifting sand. But he had to make him know.
"That night you asked me to tell all about myself,"
he whimpered despairingly.
"Oh."
He saw Max look at the floor and frown. He knew that Max was puzzled.
"You asked me questions nobody ever asked me before. You knew that I was a murderer two times over, but you treated me like a man."
Max looked at him sharply and rose from his cot. He stood in front of Bigger for a moment, and Bigger was on the verge of believing that Max knew, understood. But Max's next words showed him that the white man was still trying to comfort him in the face of death. "You're human, Bigger," Max said wearily. "It's hell to talk about things like this to one about to die." Max paused. Bigger knew that he was searching for words that would soothe him, and he did not want them. "Bigger," Max said, "in the work I'm doing, I look at the world in a way that shows no whites and no blacks, no civilized and no savages. When men are trying to change human life on Earth, those little things don't matter. You don't notice them. They're just not there. You forget them. The reason I spoke to you as I did, Bigger, is because you made me feel how badly men want to live. But sometimes I wish you hadn't asked me them questions," Bigger said in a voice that had as much reproach in it for Max as it had for himself. "What do you mean, Bigger?" "They made me think, and thinking's made me scared a little." Max caught Bigger's shoulders in a tight grip. Then his fingers loosened, and he sank back to the cot. But his eyes were still fastened upon Bigger's face. "Yes," Max knew now. Under the shadow of death, he wanted Max to tell him about life. "Mr. Max, how can I die?" Bigger asked, knowing as the words boomed from his lips that a knowledge of how to live was a knowledge of how to die. Max turned his face from him and mumbled, "Men die alone, Bigger." But Bigger had not heard him. In him again, imperiously, was the desire to talk, to tell. His hands were lifted in midair, and when he spoke, he tried to charge into the tone of his words what he himself wanted to hear, what he needed. "Mr. Max, I sort of saw myself after that night, and I sort of saw other people, too." Bigger's voice died. He was listening to the echoes of his words in his own mind. He saw amazement and horror on Max's face. Bigger knew that Max would rather not have him talk like this, but he could not help it. He had to die, and he had to talk. "Well, it's sort of funny, Mr. Max. I ain't trying to dodge what's coming to me." Bigger was growing hysterical. "I know I'm going to get it. I'm going to die. But that's all right now. But really, I never wanted to hurt nobody. That's the truth, Mr. Max. I hurt folks 'cause I felt I had to, that's all. They was crowding me too close. They wouldn't give me no room. Lots of times I tried to forget them, but I couldn't. They wouldn't let me." Bigger's eyes were wide and unseeing. His voice rushed on. "Mr. Max, I didn't mean to do what I did. I was trying to do something else. But it seemed like I never could. I was always wanting something, and I was feeling that nobody would let me have it. So I fought them. I thought they was hard, and I acted hard." He paused, then whimpered in confession. "But I ain't hard, Mr. Max. I ain't hard even a little bit." He rose to his feet. "But I won't be crying none when they take me to that chair. But I'll be feeling inside of me like I was crying. I'll be feeling and thinking that they didn't see me and I didn't see them." He ran to the steel door and caught the bars in his hands and shook them, as though trying to tear the steel from its concrete moorings. Max went to him and grabbed his shoulders. "Bigger," Max said helplessly. Bigger grew still and leaned weakly against the door. "Mr. Max, I know the folks who sent me here to die hated me. I know that. But you reckon that they was like me, trying to
to get something like I was. And when I'm dead and gone, they'll be saying like I'm saying now that they didn't mean to hurt nobody. But that they was trying to get something too.
Max did not answer. Bigger saw a look of indecision and wonder come into the old man's eyes.
Tell me, Mr. Max, you think they was?
Bigger, Max pleaded.
Tell me, Mr. Max.
Max shook his head and mumbled. You're asking me to say things I don't want to say.
But I want to know.
You're going to die, Bigger. Max's voice faded. Bigger knew that the old man had not wanted to say that. He had said it because he had pushed him, had made him say it. They were silent for a moment longer. Then Bigger whispered,
That's why I want to know. I reckon it's 'cause I know I'm going to die that makes me want to know.
Max's face was ashy. Bigger feared that he was going to leave. Across a gulf of silence, they looked at each other. Max sighed. Come here, Bigger, he said. He followed Max to the window and saw in the distance the tips of sun-drenched buildings in the loop. See all those buildings, Bigger? Max asked, placing an arm about Bigger's shoulders. He spoke hurriedly, as though trying to mold a substance which was warm and pliable, but which might soon cool.
Yeah, I see him.
You lived in one of them once, Bigger. They're made out of steel and stone. But the steel and stone don't hold them together. You know what holds those buildings up, Bigger? You know what keeps them in their place? Keeps them from tumbling down?
Bigger looked at him, bewildered.
It's the belief of men. If men stopped believing, stopped having faith, they'd come tumbling down. Those buildings sprang up out of the hearts of men, Bigger. Men like you. Men kept hungry, kept needing. And those buildings kept growing and unfolding. You once told me you wanted to do a lot of things. Well, that's the feeling that keeps those buildings in their places.
You mean, you talking about what I said that night when I said I wanted to do a lot of things?
Bigger's voice became quiet, childlike in its tone of hungry wonder.
Yes. What you felt, what you wanted, is what keeps those buildings standing there.
When millions of men are desiring and longing, those buildings grow and unfold. But Bigger, those buildings aren't growing anymore. A few men are squeezing those buildings tightly in their hands. The buildings can't unfold, can't feed the dreams men have, men like you. The men on the inside of those buildings have begun to doubt, just as you did. They don't believe anymore. They don't feel it's their world. They're restless, like you, Bigger. They have nothing. There's nothing through which they can grow and unfold. They go in the streets and they stand outside of those buildings and look and wonder.
But what they hate me for? Bigger asked.
The men who own those buildings are afraid. They want to keep what they own, even if it makes others suffer. In order to keep it, they push men down in the mud and tell them that they are beasts. But men like you, get angry and fight to re-enter those buildings, to live again. Bigger, you killed. That was wrong. That was not the way to do it. It's too late now for you to work with others who are trying to believe and make the world live again. But it's not too late to believe what you felt, to understand what you felt. Bigger was gazing in the direction of the buildings, but he did not see them. He was trying to react to the picture Max was drawing, trying to compare that picture with what he had felt all his life.
"I always wanted to do something," he mumbled.
They were silent, and Max did not speak again until Bigger looked at him. Max closed his eyes.
"Bigger, you're going to die. And if you die, die free. You're trying to believe in yourself. And every time you try to find a way to live, your own mind stands in the way. You know why that is? It's because others have said you were bad and they made you live in bad conditions. When a man hears that over and over and looks about him and sees that his life is bad, he begins to doubt his own mind. His feelings drag him forward, and his mind, full of what others say about him, tells him to go back. The job in getting people to fight and have faith is in making them believe in what life has made them feel, making them feel that their feelings are as good as those of others. Bigger, the people who hate you feel just as you feel, only they're on the other side of the fence. You're black, but that's only part of it. Your being black, as I told you before, makes it easy for them to single you out. Why do they do that? They want the things of life, just as you did, and they're not particular about how they get them. They hire people and they don't pay them enough. They take what people own and build up power. They rule and regulate life. They have things arranged so that they can do those things and the people can't fight back. They do that to black people more than others because they say that black people are inferior. But Bigger, they say that all people who work are inferior. And the rich people don't want to change things. They'll lose too much. But deep down in them, they feel like you feel, Bigger. And in order to keep what they've got, they make themselves believe that men who work are not quite human. They do like you did, Bigger, when you refused to feel sorry for Mary. But on both sides, men want to live. Men are fighting for life. Who will win? Well, the side that feels life most. The side with the most humanity and the most men. That's why you've got to believe in yourself, Bigger. Max's head jerked up in surprise when Bigger laughed. "Oh, I reckon I believe in myself. I ain't got nothing else. I got to die."
He stepped over to Max. Max was leaning against the window.
"Mr. Max, you go home. I'm all right." "Sounds funny, Mr. Max, but when I think about what you say, I kind of feel what I wanted. It makes me feel I was kind of right."
Max opened his mouth to say something, and Bigger drowned out his voice.
"I ain't trying to forgive nobody, and I ain't asking for nobody to forgive me. I ain't going to cry. They wouldn't let me live, and I killed. Maybe it ain't fair to kill. And I reckon I really didn't want to kill. But when I think of why all the killing was, I begin to feel what I wanted, what I am."
Bigger saw Max back away from him with compressed lips. But he felt he had to make Max understand how he saw things now.
"I didn't want to kill," Bigger shouted. "But what I killed for, I am. It must have been pretty deep in me to make me kill. I must have felt it awful hard to murder."
Max lifted his hand to touch Bigger, but did not.
"No, no, no. Bigger, not that," Max pleaded despairingly. "What I killed for must have been good."
Bigger's voice was full of frenzied anguish.
"It must have been good. When a man kills, it's for something.
I didn't know I was really alive in this world until I felt things hard enough to kill for 'em. It's the truth, Mr. Max. I can say it now, 'cause I'm going to die. I know what I'm saying real good, and I know how it sounds, but I'm all right. I feel all right when I look at it that way.
Max's eyes were full of terror. Several times his body moved nervously, as though he were about to go to Bigger, but he stood still.
I'm all right, Mr. Max. Just go and tell Ma I was all right, not to worry none, see? Tell her I was all right and wasn't crying none.
Max's eyes were wet. Slowly, he extended his hand. Bigger shook it.
Goodbye, Bigger, he said quietly.
Goodbye, Mr. Max.
Max groped for his hat like a blind man. He found it and jammed it on his head. He felt for the door, keeping his face averted. He poked his arm through and signaled for the guard. When he was let out, he stood for a moment, his back to the steel door. Bigger grasped the bars with both hands.
Mr. Max.
Yes, Bigger.
He did not turn around.
I'm all right. For real. I am.
Goodbye, Bigger.
Goodbye, Mr. Max.
Max walked down the corridor.
Mr. Max.
Max paused, but did not look.
Tell Jan hello.
All right, Bigger.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
He still held on to the bars. Then he smiled a faint, wry, bitter smile. He heard the ring of steel against steel as a far door clanged shut.
The End. You've been listening to Native Son by Richard Wright, narrated by Peter Francis James.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life and select from one of the many available children's audiobooks?